Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jack Watts for Jack Watts Live, normally broadcasting to you from the 10th floor of the We Believe Tower in Midtown Atlanta, overlooking the majestic Buckhead skyline. But today, I am in Palm Harbor, Florida, which is adjacent to Clearwater, enjoying the spectacular sunshine and the warm weather, and thinking of all of my friends who are freezing their derrieres off in the northern parts of the nation. Speaking of which, we have a special guest today, Ms. Swan, who is running for the 10th congressional seat in Georgia. It's an open seat. It's in the Athens all the way down to through central eastern Georgia. And Mitch went to Marquette, graduated in 87, actually was born and raised in the Boston area, I believe Belmont, which is very close to Newton, Massachusetts, where I was raised, the great bastion of liberalism, which didn't take on either Mitch or me, but it did on many of the others, no doubt about it. Mitch graduated from Marquette. Then he got an MBA at Chaminade in Honolulu, and he has been in the Marine Corps most of his adult life, where he is a colonel, which, just by the way, there aren't many people that rise to that rank in the United States. There just are very few people that have that kind of distinction. Now, I'm also going to bring my brother on the phone. Richard, I know you're there. You were in the Navy. Mitch was in the Marine Corps, and I was a Kappa Sigma. So we have a lot to talk about here today. And I'm going to say, to begin with, hello, Richard. How are you? Just say hi.
Hi.
There you go. And Mitch, you're on the line. Is that correct?
I am, Jack. Hello, Richard. Thank you both for having me on today.
And thank
you. You know what? Yeah, thank you for it. Absolutely, positively. And here's the thing. We have a nation that has a lot of problems, and there are some things that, you know, desperately need attention. And there are people that have, you know, quite a good capacity, including my brother and I, at cursing the darkness. What we need, of course, is more than that. We need people who have some fresh ideas of how some things can be done in this nation to change. And Mitch has some. And he's got a five-star plan, his five laws, that he wants to change fundamentally some of the things, and he's running for Congress to do so. So I'm going to just say, Mitch, you just do most of the talking. We'll just interrupt and ask some questions every now and then. But this program is yours. And just by the way, listeners, Mitch is going to get an opportunity to tell his entire program on the air. And we're going to post these sessions, these radio programs, so that they will be archived. And people will be able to listen to them so that they can get a full benefit of what Mitch has to say. So, Mitch, it's your floor now, buddy. Go ahead.
Well, thank you both very much, and I appreciate the opportunity, Jack. Yeah, we both did go up north, and I'll just add to your point that not only do we keep our conservative values up there from the north, but one of the things I enjoy about you is we are both men of faith, and that is also becoming quite rare in the Northeast. So why am I running for Congress, I am asked. And many people sense that there is a problem in our nation. How can we be great again? And it's all relative. We are still a great nation, but we have perhaps lost some of our greatness over the last few decades. And for us to get back to the stature that we once enjoyed, there are three things that our nation absolutely must have. And these are three things that every great nation must have. The first is moral fortitude. Every nation of consequence absolutely, positively must have a common sense of values that the society shares. What's good and evil, right and wrong, acceptable and unacceptable. It doesn't matter if you're a Western civilization or a socialist civilization. Those are required. It's a base for common behavior. Now, in all
you know, this is this is the Toynbee theory of history, where you know, and actually Jeremy Bentham did a great deal of work on this. Said you know, is in the British Parliament, and with the idea that all of society is like a tapestry that is, you know, has all of these threads woven, and you could hold it up and put things of great weight, and it would support it. But when you cut the morality of the nation just one little snip of a thread at a time, ultimately the whole thing will give way and collapse, and the weight will go right through it. And this is pretty much what Mitch is talking about, but we're going to continue with it. Go ahead, Mitch.
Yeah. No, but, and you're absolutely right. And when those lines of behavior become blurred, every nation fails. And that is just a historical fact. And this doesn't mean that in our Western societies, which were based on Judeo-Christian ethics, that we insist on everyone being Jewish or Christian. It does not mean that. It simply means that those rules, those laws of good behavior, are what we adhere to. And I think whether Richard, me, or you, Jack, went to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, we know that while there, we have to follow their customs of defined social behavior. And so that's where we are. So we need to get moral fortitude back in our nation. I lean to the churches to start leading that charge. But a lot of Christians have become like Jonah, and not Jonah inside the whale, but Jonah sitting up on the hill looking down at the city underneath the leaf, waiting for God to pass his judgment, because we've almost all hit that point of apathy. You know, I want to do something, but I don't know what to do, so I'm just going to leave it in God's hands. But I think that as Jonah learned, we have to take charge, and he's going to hold us to account to continue to do work down here. So that takes me to financial responsibility. So Christians say, well, what can I do to make the country better? I get it. You want moral fortitude. But how do we rebuild our financial house? And that is what my plan is all about. It's called the 5-Star Plan. There are 5 points to this star, and each point of this plan must be done completely, and it must be done in order, because we have some complex problems, and we'll discuss those together. The final part is military strength. You know, for every nation, you must be able to defend your civilization and also export your beliefs. Now, on that point, one of the things, we are still the greatest nation on earth militarily, without question. But what we lack these days, and most people are sensing this, is what is referred to as moral authority. And moral authority defines for us and for our allies and for our enemies. These are the things that we believe in, the things that we will fight for. And right now, our allies, partners, and friends no longer trust us as a nation. They don't know what we stand for. They're confused. Our enemies no longer fear us because they think that we have not defined a line in the sand that can't be crossed. And so what we need to do is get back to moral authority with our military for our foreign policy. And I think many of you that are at least our age, perhaps, you know, 1961, John F. Kennedy said in his inaugural address, he outlined moral authority beautifully when he paraphrased, "Let all nations know, whether they wish us well or ill, we will bear any burden, pay any price, endure any hardship to defend liberty, freedom." But we don't speak in those terms any longer, do we? We speak of economic prosperity, regional security, security cooperation. They're nebulous terms that mean nothing. So when my aircraft carriers park off the coast of Libya or some other nation, the people go, what do the Americans want? Because it's not known to them why we're there. So if those are the three things, and we can agree that we need to have moral fortitude, financial responsibility, and military strength, focus on those three things for our nation, we can be great again.
Now,
so that takes us to
you know,
financial responsibility.
You know, it's interesting you're talking about the moral authority. I was noticing in the paper the other day. It was actually it was something I read online that was from Israel, and there are only 12% of the Israelis that believe that we have their back right now with this administration. 12% less are very fearful and absolutely believe that the road for Iran to get nukes is being easily paved by the United States right now. Now, whether I kind of share that view, at the same time, I know that when we have our chief ally, only 12% of them leaving us, that does not bode well for the future in the Middle East, not at this point anyway. So, at any rate, you were talking, and I just want every once in a while just bring in something.
Oh, no, you're right.
But at any rate, you just go ahead.
No, that's very contemporary, isn't it? And I would say that the numbers of Americans that believe that we're covering Israel's back is declined as well, because we're confused. And that all goes back to that moral fortitude. When you define what you believe in and what you stand for and practice it in your own borders domestically, then you can export those ideals of freedom and liberty. But I think as Americans now, we don't even know that our own government with domestic surveillance has our own back. Where is my liberty? Where is my freedom in those programs right now with the NSA? It's unknown to me. It's undefined. So stepping back now, going to the financial piece, when a Christian says to me, well, Mitch, I really want to get back to our Judeo-Christian values. I want to build that foundation. But, geez, the country's done and gone. What can we do to fix it? Well, we have some complex problems. People talk about our national debt. Nationally, our public debt is $17 trillion. But people don't understand part of our domestic debt is our private debt, the debt that I owe, that Richard owes, that you owe, that your listeners owe. When you add our credit cards, our car payments, our home mortgages, we as a nation individually owe $38 trillion. Now, that's private debt. Together, the public and private debt equal $55 trillion that is current debt that we must pay with only $15 trillion of actual income, earnings for our nation, our GDP as a nation. So we're
so that means that if our GDP is a little over $16 trillion, then what we owe, that based upon our debt, based upon what houses and everything else, that if we worked every day for 4 years and didn't take anything and just paid back, we'd be to square one, or close.
Absolutely.
To 4 years. That's a little bit discouraging.
Well, it is. And what is discouraging for Americans, and you need to think of this, we have to become selfish as a nation. When the government says to you that its sovereign debt is so important that we must raise taxes in order to meet them, and for us to pull in our belts, for them to be able to honor their promises and contracts, we are saying that our $38 trillion is not as important. And I would make the argument that the sovereign promises each of us as individuals have made to one another to honor contracts, to pay for our bills, and to honor our mortgages is way more sovereign and way more important for our economy than for us to keep shoveling money up to Congress, because they are making no effort to pull in their belt and making no effort to reduce their spending. So, with those ideas in mind, there are two realities I really want your listeners to understand. And these are those. When you do a global assessment, there are two certainties right now. One, violence is increasing around the world, and it is higher right now than it has ever been prior to any world war. Whether we want to talk about Africa generally or North Africa specifically, if we want to talk about the Middle East, looking at what's happening in Egypt and Yemen and Syria and Iraq now falling to Al-Qaeda. Whether we look in the Central Asia states, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the unrest there and that Muslim unrest right now as a threat to Russia. Whether we swing out and then look at the Pacific. And in the Pacific, we have nations that are competing for resources, whether it's fuel, oil reserves, whether it's fishing industry rights. There is such an appetite for resources that smaller countries are being pressured and feel pressure from China, who is expanding because it has a growing appetite. And then how will those fishing rights and those minerals in the ocean be impacted by the Fukushima nuclear reactor that's now still leaking into the Pacific Ocean? We've bought 14 million doses of iodine for American citizens on the West Coast. The government has 14 million doses. What does that say of the water contamination that is continually growing out there in the Pacific? Will we find a day when maybe the fish, maybe you and I right now go to Publix and we say, geez, I like sushi, but where did this tuna come from? Is it Atlantic tuna or is it Pacific tuna? And those are the things that will drive that region in the Western Pacific crazy. Not only will the people potentially lose a food source for themselves, but an economic source of export. And so when we look at that, so I have all this unrest, right? That's what I'm trying to say, is that there's increasing pressure, increasing unrest going around the world. And on the other side, I have expanding debt. Our global debt exceeds global GDP, much like it does here in the U.S. So if I have global debt increasing and global violence increasing, can they go on indefinitely? And the answer is no. So how will we as a nation be able to face that? And I don't know which one will go first, whether it'll be armed conflict or whether it'll be financial collapse. But how will we as a nation weather it? Because right now as a nation, we are absolutely in a spiritual and philosophical battle for the soul of this country. And we don't know who we want to be. And that's why we need to get back to that moral fortitude. So with those two things in place, what I now look at is I say, we have got to get our financial house in order. And there is a way to do it. Even though people have become cynical, there's a way to do it. And we can look towards Congress right now. We know they're devoid of ideas, right? They're at 8% approval rating. And after two decades of thinking about the immigration problem, the best that they have is just shrugging their shoulders and say, let's do amnesty. So in my plan, the first thing I address is immigration reform. We're going to fix our immigration problem. Now, I understand that some listeners feel...
Okay, so this is the first thing. The first problem, of the myriad of problems that we have, this is the first one that we're going to intend to do is illegal immigration, resolve that issue. That's number one.
Yes, sir. In fact, I'll tell you each 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 right now so that people can conceptually kind of visualize where I'm going to walk us towards. I'm going to resolve immigration. I'm then going to do tax reform for our nation. And by doing those two, I can then solve Social Security, make it solvent for our children and for ourselves. I'm then going to downsize the federal government. And I'm then going to eliminate unions. We're going to reform our labor force in the federal government. I don't actually get rid of all the unionized labor right away. I just change the way that we employ people in the future. So those are the five things. Now, immigration is number one for me. And it's actually because I can use it to our advantage as a nation to solve the other problems. And I think you'll understand where I'm going with this. Amnesty absolutely can't be done. Amnesty sounds good to states like Maine, Vermont, Minnesota. Great, if you're a northern state, you don't have many illegal immigrants. But you're in the southern border regions, it's very expensive, very costly. Think California, Nevada,
yeah.
Arizona. So what I'm going to do is we have a population roughly 12 to 15 million of illegal immigrants. I'm going to assume, and I want as many to participate as possible, but I'd like to have 10 million participate. And this is how my plan works. I let them fund the solution. See, amnesty makes us incur the cost as taxpayers to absorb them. What I want them to do is I'm going to open up a window of enrollment 3 to 6 months so that people can't sneak into my border. You get here 7 months from now, you can't enroll anyways. You're illegal, you get deported. But in that small window, they will sign up. And from the date of signing up, they will have 36 months before they can achieve American citizenship. I give them full citizenship. They're going to pay a fee of $3,600 per person. Now, to some people, that sounds expensive, but it's not. It's $100 a month. It's $3.40 a day. That is the first.
That's a Starbucks. That's a Starbucks today.
Yes, sir. A Starbucks today. Well said. It's a tall latte. So what?
All right. Okay. All right. Okay. We've got 15 million, and your plan is to have these people essentially out themselves, say who they are, and your goal is to get 2/3 of them to participate that would go towards citizenship. Am I following?
You are following, and here's the beauty of the
program. Okay. All right. So I want everybody to be able to understand this. All right. So then these people, these 10 million, would each of them pay $3,600 or a Starbucks a day for a year?
3 years.
3 years. Okay, so the total is 10 grand?
No, sir. They're going to pay over that 36-month period, they must pay us $3,600. That's $100 a month
total.
For 36 months. $1,200
okay.
a year. And so.
All right, and so then with that $10 million, that would, the total of that would be?
$36 billion.
Billion.
Now, billion. And so what we do with that $1 billion, that fee revenue, we let the federal government keep one-third, $12 billion, to apply towards border security. As you recall,
okay.
Jack, our fence on the southern border was supposed to cost $600 million, and
right.
now I'm giving them $12 billion. So we have more options now for securing our southern border. But the state in which these immigrants signed up gets to keep the two-thirds of the fee they were paid. So for every million people in California, and there's far more than 1 million illegal immigrants, but for every million, that is $2.4 billion that California gets to keep for itself and use for its own discretionary spending, however they see fit. They could pay for infrastructure. They could pay for social services. They could use it to attract and entice businesses now to come to California again. So here in Georgia, we have less than 500,000, but to keep the math easy, I'll say it's 500,000. That is $1.2 billion for the state of Georgia to use at its own discretion, and we would give $600 million, one-third, to the federal government for it to apply to southern border security. Now, some people have said to me, Mitch, it seems far too cheap, $3,600. This is America. Make them pay more. Well, remember, in our country right now, when they get full citizenship, and by the way, they must speak English, basic English, and they must pass the immigration exam as well that all immigrants take, and they must not be convicted of a crime, right? But once at the end of this rainbow in 36 months for these people, they still owe, just like you and I, $52,000 per person for the federal debt. They must buy into these healthcare exchanges. They must pay taxes and Social Security. And so how do I know who's enrolled or not? Well, those people will get a legal resident card, expiration date, 36 months from the date of issue. And with that card, they can work anywhere. They don't have to just pick strawberries or work in poultry plants. They can actually go sell cars, work at Starbucks, get another job, maybe a job with benefits. And so now they're covered. They can work anywhere they want. But understanding in doing this, I have just expanded our labor force by 10 million people. Now, I would also share with your listeners, some people...
This increases the labor force. It incentivizes them to earn citizenship rather than just be in the shadows or just get it handed to them, which is something that, you know, most people just don't want to have happen and don't think is fair, and it isn't fair. But so this sounds fair to me. This sounds like many of these people have lived here a long time, and they have kids that are in school, and
they will have to pay for their children too. I mean, a family of five will owe us $18,000. But at the end of the day, as you said, that's five Starbucks lattes a day. But they can work anywhere they want. The other thing I would point out is certainly as an employer, and you have been in the past, Jack, these poultry plants where these immigrants work or the dairy farms, they'll say, I know this guy can work anywhere, but he's so good, I don't want to lose him. That employer has the right to sponsor their good workers as a way of enticing them to stay on. And
they could essentially make that part of their compensation package to keep the good workers. This is not a bad idea. What do you think, Dick? You haven't said, what do you think about this that he's talking about?
Well, it's just common sense. It makes an awful lot of sense. And I wouldn't say it's a it's not a bad idea, Jack. I'd say it's a damn good idea.
Well, thank you both. And I believe the illegals would agree with us because I think they want to keep their dignity. They don't want to have anyone say they got a handout. And for those Americans right now that say, well, you know, it's going to change the demographics of our nation. Listen, we're already changing our own demographics by slipping away from our Judeo-Christian values. And the day that our nation does not want 10 million people with a Christian heritage and a heritage of family values and a strong work ethic, that's the day America's gone forever. And keep in mind, too, right now, between now and 2017, we are importing by INS standards directed by the administration, 500,000 Somalis. So I'm importing people with Islamic background, poorly educated, and dirt poor. So you put that...
And they hate America.
Yeah, correct. And so I...
And one of the Christians did.
We need to embrace these Latino brothers and sisters. We need to embrace them. But then here's where they become the solution, guys. This is where the plan gets exciting, right? Because I've expanded the labor force. But think of this. I've also expanded the tax base, which is very hard to do with declining birth rates. So I've expanded our tax base. But now in order, the first bill gives them, makes them Americans. It just makes them Americans. What gives them the American dream is Bill 2 and Bill 3. Bill 2 and Bill 3 for us restores our middle class. For all those Americans that have been trying to get back into the middle class that they feel they've lost over the last 7 years, Bill 2 and 3 does that. Tax reform. I have got to now get my economy going. I must create jobs. And the only way I can do that is to break out of these doldrums that we're in right now. I do that by going to a flat tax, 15% per individual, 20% for corporations. Now, we'll talk about the benefit of that flat tax, but I also want to add the other points. There will be no capital gains tax under this plan. There will be no dividend tax. There will be no interest tax. There will be no punitive taxes for your investments or your savings accounts. So your wealth will grow faster. I also eliminate all tax credits. People don't think of those tax credits when they do their tax forms as welfare are a form of welfare. We eliminate that. For the small business owners, those mom and pops, like the florist downtown, they pay overhead, and then they hire people, and they also try to market their products at a reasonable price to compete with big retailers. The one thing that they can't compete very evenly with is online retailers, because those people have no presence physically. Their warehouses are overseas, somewhere far away domestically, and they don't pay sales tax. So the last piece I do is I do encourage and want and push for an 8% sales tax on the internet to make it a more even playing field when people are purchasing from local merchants or buying something on their iPhone. So the local merchants can't compete on price when something is tax-free on the internet. You follow me?
I do. Okay. Now, listen, we've got a minute and a half left. I want you, for this particular show, I want you to just kind of summarize.
Great. I'll summarize this. So we've just summarized what we covered today or the rest of the plan real fast.
No, I would say what we've done today, just knowing what people are like, that, you know, just tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them what you told them.
Great. Well, with the first two bills, we've resolved immigration. We did not do amnesty. Amnesty will break our country. We did it in a fair, equitable manner, and we're making them permanent American citizens. And then we're going to reform our tax process, reform our tax code, so that we can accumulate wealth faster as a nation, encourage jobs to come back within our borders, and get our economy going for everyone's benefit.
Now, that sounds like some pretty good stuff to me, if you want to know the truth. And, you know, let me just say this. Mitch is a solid guy. He is a solid leader. He has distinguished himself not only academically, but as a colonel in the Marine Corps. He's a good guy. He's smart. He's trustworthy. And he's the kind of candidate that we need in Washington, D.C., someone who has an iPhone. And that's all that we have time for today, folks. So let me say thank you, Mitch. Thanks, Dick. And God bless both of you. And God bless the United States of America. Good night.
Amen.